session number 9253, reel 32.
Jack Dorgan, reel 32. How would you, besides the scouting activities which we've covered, how would the miners and yourself spend their leisure time? Would they go to pubs or clubs, anything like that?
Well, at Ashenden, I don't know if I've mentioned it before, but the whole area, the land around Ashenden for miles, they belonged to one family, and they were a Quaker family. Forget the name for the moment, but they were the landowners, and all the land, when people built houses, they were leasehold. No freehold houses in Ashenden, because the owners of the land, this Quaker family, which later, I understand, split up into different groups as the families grew, they they laid down there will only be three public houses in the whole of the Ashenden area. And when I say the Ashenden area, I talk about maybe 6 miles in one way, 6 miles in another way. Now then, these three public houses are still there in existence today. And each of the three were 1 mile apart from each other. So they were like in a triangle. If you were in the White Elephant public house, on the right-hand side would be the Grand Hotel, but it was a mile from you. And the other pub, the Portland, it was a mile in the other direction. See, with the Grand Hotel, it had each pub was a mile apart, and it was a triangle.
Did you ever visit?
But that was that was in the very early days of the last century, the 18th century, when I was a boy. In 1900, I was 7 years old, and that was the position then, in those days. But what happened when Ashenden began to get developed, when the pits began to employ several thousand men, and the Ashenden Coal Company built houses and houses and houses, until I had hundreds of houses built by the Ashenden Colliery. They didn't realize or didn't know that workmen would combine and have what is now called working men's clubs. And at one time in Ashenden, before I left Ashenden, there was 21 working men's clubs distributed over the whole of the Ashenden and Hurst area.
During the war, though, the First World War, would you visit the pubs or clubs existent at that time?
No, I never went to many pubs. No.
Would many of the miners?
Oh, yes. Some fellas only lived for that. I once wrote a story about Geordie Thompson. Geordie Thompson was an old miner, the big family. And the story is worth telling. Geordie Thompson had, I think it's 4 or 5 sons, and he also had a nephew to make another. And there was only one daughter in that miner's family. Miners' daughters at that time, before the First World War, had a very hard time, the miner's daughter. Of course, so had the miner's wife. Because big families seemed to be the order of the day. And the oldest daughter always had to help her mother to look after the men who went to work. Because the men who went to work down the pit in those years, in those days, they worked hard, they lived hard, and they had to be looked after. Many of them worked so hard that they found relief in going to the Working Men's Club or the Grand or the Portland or the White Elephant pub and filled themselves. Some, like old Geordie Thompson, only went on a Saturday night. Geordie Thompson only went to the pub on a Saturday night. The rest of the week, like a lot of old miners at that time, as I remember, were quite happy just to stay at home. But the younger men, who liked to drink, would go two or three nights a week. Of course, there was lots of sport in Ashendon at that time, before the First World War. Men played at quoits, Q-U-O-I-T-S, quoits. It's an iron circular, about 14 inches, 13 inches in diameter, and just a rim of iron. And it had a pitch, a clay pitch, 22 yards apart. A pitch, soil would be taken out in the field, and it would be filled full of clay. 22 yards away would be another pitch. And men used to play quoits a lot. Football, of course. Northumberland and the Durham is noted for football.
These sporting activities continue into the war.
Still continue today. Oh yes, still quoits are still played today. Then football, of course, has always been a favourite sport in Northumberland and Durham. Many of today's footballers in other clubs throughout the country originate from Northumberland and Durham. Because Northumberland especially is noted as a football county. And for instance, some years after the war, we might digest, in Ashendon we had 7 different football leagues, each league of 10 or 12 teams. In the years in which I'm talking about, before the war, the scouts had a league of their own. The scout troops, they had a league of their own. The Sunday schools had a league of their own. And all the working men's clubs, of course, had a league. They were in one league.
And this sport wasn't affected by the war?
Well, yes, of course. In many ways it was. Because, I mean, restrictions and all kinds of things.
What sort of restrictions?
Well, one can't help think at the moment, but...
Was it reduced or did it stop altogether?
Pardon?
Were these football leagues reduced or did they stop altogether?
No, but the football leagues was very much reduced. Oh, no. No, I've got photographs of one of my scrapbooks, of my scout troop, which was taken during the war, while I was away in France, in Belgium. Oh, no. And cricket, of course, but Northumberland is not noted for cricket. In the town of Ashendon, before the First World War, there was only one cricket club, Ashendon Cricket Club. And as I said before, there was those umpteen leagues of football teams.
Did you have other sorts of recreation that you'd go to? Were there cinemas or evening classes or anything like that you'd go to?
Well, of course, there was evening classes for... Yes, oh yes. There was evening classes for men to go in for the ambulance ticket to get a deputy's job. So every winter, there was ambulance classes, first aid classes. And then women had first aid classes too, with their activities. And of course, there were other activities with regard to sport. I mean, on Newbiggin Moor, which is just outside of Ashington, I remember on a Sunday, going down on the Sunday morning, and there would be bowling across the moor. Newbiggin Moor, right on the coastline, outside of the town of Newbiggin. Newbiggin, by the way, is only a couple of miles from Ashington. It would be a stretch of land, 2.5-3 miles in length, and about half a mile wide from the sea. It was moorland. And on a Sunday morning, in the summertime especially, men in the long johns in those days didn't have sport gear, you know, as they have today. They could be in the long johns, the men, and they would have a bowl similar in size to bowls that you use on the bowling green of today. And they had to travel that distance across the moor from one point to another. And he would be financed or helped by his working men's club. Most of the working men's club would enter it, a man, strong-armed man, who could bowl his wood in the shortest number of throws to win the game. Then, of course, in the First World War, before the First World War, my father, he went to the grammar school and was looked upon as someone a little different to ordinary men, because ordinary fellows at those days only went to the ordinary school, elementary school. He had a stopwatch. And in the town, or the village rather, of Choppington, before the First World War, he was the only man known to have a stopwatch. And he was greatly in demand for the pigeon racing. Pigeon racing, they would have a basket the size of an ordinary table, about 3'6" by 2'6", wicker made, and a depth of about 8 inches. And pigeons would be put in there, trained flying pigeons, and be sent to France. Pigeon flying was very, very prominent in my school days, especially, because I was interested from the fact that my father was always on the job with his stopwatch, because he had the job of registering the pigeons when they arrived back right from France to the village of Choppington.
During the war, would any of these trained pigeons be used as messenger pigeons? Did you know anything about that?
No, I don't know nothing about that. But each pigeon, to continue, each pigeon had a ring on its leg, on one of its legs, with a number. And that ring had to be taken off and was put in to a box a locked box had arrived. But my father, with his stopwatch, had the time of its arrival back from the continent. That was one of the big sports in those days.
During 1917, would you go to the cinema or the theatre at all in Ashington?
1917? Don't think so. I don't think it was... Oh, yes. Oh, when I went to school. I went to school to Choppington. And in Choppington was the Star Theatre. The Star Theatre, down on the main road. And the Star Theatre used to put on shows, and as the war came nearer, films used to be shown. I remember the Star Theatre, there was only two prices, downstairs and upstairs. The upstairs was a sort of a balcony. Neither the upstairs nor the downstairs had cushions on their seats. Just had wooden seats, the whole of the downstairs. Those short-sighted would get at the front, and the sweetheart and couples would get at the back. And then there was the balcony. But it also, for all you paid a penny or tuppence more, it also didn't have any cushions on the seats.
Where would you take your wife, your future wife, in 1917? 'Cause you were married.
Dance halls. I met my wife in a dance hall. Northumberland has always been keen on dancing, you know. Always been keen on dancing. You were not far from Scotland, well, the next county to Scotland, and of course Scotland is noted for its dancing, Highland dancing and so on. But Northumberland also. Every village and town had its dance hall. Me, before the First World War, when I was only 18, 19, I used to hire a dance hall and hire a band, and I used to MC my own dances in aid of money for the scout troop for every Saturday night. So dancing was very, very keen.
Would you still do that
into
the war, though?
Into the war? Oh, yes, it would carry on in the war. Oh, yes.
So the regular dance
oh, yes, because in 1917, you see, I was back again. I met my wife before the war in the dance hall. I was 19 and she was 18. And we were sweethearts, as we call couples in those times, in those places. And didn't we never got married till 1918. I have to talk about that day when I was married because I was called up again.
We'll come to that. There's just one other thing I'd like to clear up. I believe your brother was given a white feather at some point in the war and indeed joined up. Could you tell me that story?
Well, it's a long story. Yes. Well, to come back to the Dorgan family, my family, my parents had three sons. I was the oldest son. And then I had a brother called Tom. And then I had a brother called Nickel. Now, I was very active in the Scout movement. And my two brothers, of course, were members of the Scout troop. And Tom... first of all, I joined the Territorial Army, and in 1914 was called up in the Territorials. In 1915 I went overseas. In 1916 I was wounded, and I was wounded in the leg, and spent over a year. Convalescent, mostly in Staffordshire, and then back home I was put on class W, which meant that I could go back to work in the pits. I could go back to work in the pits, but live at home, convalescent, but liable to be called up at any time. And now, that meant that in 1917, I was back home on this class W, and in that time, my brother Tom, the next one to me, he had joined up previously, and he was in the Royal Naval Division down in Sussex, stationed in Sussex. Nicol, the youngest, was 18 year old, I remember, when I came back in 1917 on Class W. He worked at North Seton Colliery and was a very keen supporter of the Wesleyan Church at the Hurst, Ashington. He was the superintendent in charge of the Sunday School. A very good living young fella, very keen on his church and his Sunday School and his youth, what I don't know what to call it, but the youth society for the boys and girls in the church. Well, now, when I came home wounded on Class W, Nicol was at home, and then one morning, having a breakfast, postman came, and he dropped a letter. He gave a letter to mother, and mother dropped the letter in front of Nicol. He says, "This is for you." Nicol opened his letter, and a white feather dropped out. There was nothing else in that envelope, just the white feather. I remember Nicol was in a reserved occupation, working down the colliery, hunting down the pit, a good living lad. He got up off that table, white-faced, and he went out of the house. That was the last time I ever saw him alive, Nicol. He left the house and went to the recruiting agent in Newcastle and joined the Durham Light Infantry. Never once came home. When he was in training in England, kept in touch with his mother. And then eventually was sent out to France. My brother Tom was in the Royal Naval Division, 1917. I was at home, still convalescent on Class W, but very fit by then because I was getting fitter every day, and I was home until I was very, very fit. And my leg injury, after a full year convalescent, didn't trouble me. Then we got a ward of his letter. Mother opened the letter. It was to inform us that her son Tom was severely wounded in France. This was in 1917. Severely wounded in France. And arrangements could be made, if you wished, for you and your husband to go and visit your son in the hospital in France. And this was 1917. And if you wish to go to France, the Salvation Army would make all arrangements and escort you to the hospital in France. Well, I was at home working in the pits. Nickel was in the forces, Durham Light Infantry, and by that time had been sent to France. So mother and father, together with the Salvation Army officer and myself, went down to London. I went down to London with them. I wanted to go with them, if possible, to see Brother Nickel, Tom, Father, who was severely wounded in France. One father, with the Salvation Army officer, went over to France, and I went down again to the War Office in London and arranged for my brother Nickel, who was in France somewhere, I didn't know where, to visit the hospital at the same time as our mother and father was visiting his brother Tom. So that when mother and father arrived with the Salvation Army officer at this hospital in France, Nickel arrived a couple of days or so afterwards. And so he was able to see his mother and father and Tom, who was severely wounded, in the hospital. Nickel only had 2 days leave, where mother and father were to stay in the hospital 8 days, so that Nickel had to leave the hospital and go back to his unit, leaving mother and father in the hospital where they were visiting brother Tom. Well, they finished their trip, and Tom eventually recovered to a certain extent, though he was never able to do a full day's work because they took two top ribs off his chest, removed them entirely from that injury that he got while he was in hospital. So that while they were still in the hospital, Nickel went back to his unit. It transpired, from what we learned afterwards, first of all, when we came back from England, from the visit, about a week or so later, my father was in the club, Working Men's Club, and he says he met a fella in the club who was back from France on leave. It was men, soldiers coming back to England on leave. And this fella from Ashington was back on leave from France, where he was stationed. And he stopped my dad and says, "I've seen your son, Nickel, as he was going up into the trenches." He said, "He told me that you had been out to visit your other son." I said, "Oh, yes." My father said, "Oh, yes." He says, "Was he all right?" "Yes, he was fine. We only had a few minutes because I was coming out of the trenches while he was going in." Then we received, about a week or more later, a communication from the War Office to say Nickel Dorgan, Durham Light Infantry, had been killed in France. That's all it said. But we received also a letter from his sergeant. And the sergeant says in his letter, Nickel was coming back from the hospital.